Asia, a non-alcoholic. My sobriety date is September 12th, 2021. My home group is Into Action in Richmond, Virginia. We meet Tuesdays and Thursdays. And Into Action is literally literally a great name for this group. We take meetings into jails and treatment centers. We're active with the Public Information Committee. There are a lot of great ways to serve in that home group, and I truly love it. It was funny when I was, started going to that meeting, I really kind of fell in love with it. But I said to my sponsor, they meet twice a week, though. And she said, oh, that's awful, isn't it? Twice a week. And, that's because I can be very inherently selfish. My first inclination had always been not to think of you, but to think of myself constantly. So I'm just going to start it off. I was born in Traverse City, Michigan. And when I was a baby, we moved to a town about an hour north of New York City called Middletown, New York. And I remember just being really rebellious from a really young age. I always had to challenge things, challenge adults and challenge rules. I remember we rented a farmhouse from a man named Willie Weinstock. Isn't that a great name for a farm? And there was a big pond out behind our house. I was probably 4 or 5. And my mom was always afraid that I'd wander off behind the pond and, something bad would happen. So I remember I was taking ballet classes and I had little ballerina slippers on. And I snuck down to the pond. And I remember just sticking my toe into the water just to see what would happen. Because my mother always said, the water will pull you in. Stay away from the pond. It'll pull you in. And I remember just thinking, nothing pulled me in. I've got this. That was pretty much, the way I thought and felt even as a young kid. So the first time I remember ever drinking, I was about 5 or 6. And we were at a wedding. And there were lots of little kids around. And I had a really pretty dress on. And we were all running around and laughing and dancing. And the tables were level with my head. And I could distinctly remember running around the tables and finishing people's drinks. And no one really saw me do that. But I remember succinctly a warm feeling in my chest. And I felt invincible. And I was running around yelling, I'm drunk, I'm drunk. And, I guess that was funny at the time. And I remember I had a little dress on. And I pulled up the dress and said, see my dressy? And that's pretty much the way the rest of my drinking career went. Pretty much. I was always like a really wild kid, very, very daring. I would do, I'm an adrenaline junkie and I would always do kind of crazy, crazy things. So there are other substances in my story. I'll just not get into them. Alcohol was always the mainstay of what was going on with me. So I remember the first time that I smoked pot, I was 15 and fell deeply in love with just feeling outside of myself. I was always looking to feel outside of myself, and alcohol helped with that too a great deal. So I became an everyday, I always did something to change my mood every day. And I went to a private grade school and was very strict. And I was a big class clown. I remember I spent my third grade pretty much with my desk out in the hall, making faces at all the kids. And I got in trouble a lot. I was at the principal's office pretty regularly. They would call my mom and have her come pick me up. I was just kind of wild. And this was really before I got into my stride of, full-blown alcoholism. So when I was about 6, well, okay, so I went through grade school. And then I went to a private high school, which was also very strict, very strict. If you had a rivet on your pants, you got a demerit. And things just got really crazy in high school. And, we would play this game And if someone had a car that had a roof rack on it, we'd stand on the hood, on the roof of the car, and the person would swerve. And if you fell off, you'd have to buy beer. And that was just stupid stuff that I did just to be wild. I found the people that drank exactly like I did. And things went on in freshman year, and I was asked not to return in sophomore year. And I remember the principal saying, we just don't think that you're the type of material that we strive for in this school. And I remember that just hurt my feelings so badly. And I felt like such a victim. I never stopped to think what a distraction I was. And what a pain in the neck I was to every teacher and the dean of students in that school. That didn't come till much, much later that I truly saw what my actions, how that affects people. Because when we're in the middle of it, when I'm in the middle of, my illness, I have no idea what I'm doing to you guys, how I'm hurting you, what my lying does, just constant torture for others. And it took me a long time to realize that. So I went to a public school in sophomore year, and the freedom hit me like a ton of bricks. It was like a small city. I came from a high school that had probably 300 kids in that high school. And Middletown Public School was it was just overwhelming. And I remember I would take the bus to school. And I'd sneak off with the other kids and skip school. I probably lasted about a month. I went to three or four classes, and I was actually singing jingles for the radio, and I was taking voice lessons. And my mom would pick me up from voice lessons and just be so disgusted because I hadn't been at school, and I stank of alcohol. And she said, "I'm not going to get you these voice lessons anymore. It's just a waste of my money." And my parents were a little older when I was born. They were awesome people. My father was a editor of the newspaper there in town. And when I was 7, he was ordained a Orthodox Catholic priest. And I remember we used to go to we had a small congregation, and even then, just a little creepy kid, I would take dollars out of the basket when they got passed around. And I just didn't have any connection with anything. I loved my parents deeply, but I was just a selfish little kid bent on destruction. So I remember telling my father also helped prisoners in jail get their GEDs. And he was a college professor as well. Just a very learned, wonderful man in his obit. They said that he was warm, witty, and irreverent. And that was my pop for sure. So I remember telling him that I was quitting school and I wanted to be out in the world. I wanted to work. And he got, teary, and he said, "Don't do this. You're not going to go back to school. Don't quit. Please don't quit." And I had to. So I quit. And, time rolled on. I met someone online for hot dogs at a Bob Dylan concert in Madison Square Garden. And I remember I turned around and here's this gorgeous, gorgeous man. And I turned around and said, "Excuse me, do you have a light?" And I mean, that was it. Just I heard angels singing. And this guy lived in Brooklyn. So, a month later, "Mom, Pop, I'm moving to Brooklyn." And my poor little Italian mother be like, "Oh, mommy," because I was just such a wreck. They tried a child psychologist to talk to me. I would get grounded and then sneak down. There was a woodshed right under my window. I'd sneak out and ride off on my bike. And I remember I took their car one time. They were going away, and my big sister was watching me. And I took their Ford Pinto. And as I was driving down the road, they had forgotten something. And are driving back in my parents' faces. I was like, "Oh, I'm so busted right now." I just did all kinds of things like that, just not caring about anyone. And as I got older, and I ended up quitting school, I was very fiercely independent. So I got my own apartment, and then I met this person, and I moved to Brooklyn. And joined a rock band, and that's where I was introduced to harder substances. And for 3 years I lived there, and I don't remember a lot of it. Morally, I wasn't doing the right things. I was drunk and high all the time. And my boyfriend at the time, Michael, worked for the plumbers union, so he had a great job. And when the bus would drop him off from work, he would just pick up a knapsack that he had and take off for 3 days. So all I could see were his problems, his errors. This guy, why am I picking such losers? I couldn't see anything about my behavior and what I was doing. And mind you, very codependent. I never could be by myself. I always had to have a boyfriend waiting in the wings. Can't be alone. If things are going south, which they always did, I had to have someone that I would just take right up with, because I never wanted to, even when I was alone, I would begin to think like these little, fleeting thoughts that you're just, this something's not right. You're just crazy. You're doing these crazy things. I would jump off of a 40-foot waterfall while drinking, and jump out of a moving car during an argument with someone, and just tuck and roll down the hill, and just wake up with bruises the next day and couldn't wait to do it again. People say that, I heard someone say that he was so drunk that he tried to use his calculator as an alarm clock, and that that was the insanity. That's not really the insanity. The insanity for me was doing these things over and over and over again, harming myself. And not at this time, I had no idea that I wanted to stop. I just figured I'd go on, to the bitter end and be someone's drunk grandmother sitting on the porch. So I moved back from Brooklyn, and my father was diagnosed with bladder cancer. And my mom was scared to death to drive to the Bronx. There was a prominent cancer hospital in the Bronx called Sloan Kettering. And my mom, I told my mom that I would drive them while he had his chemo treatments. And I don't think I ever did it once. My mom would call me. I'd be at a friend's house or at my apartment. And she'd say, your father and I are going, we have a 4:30 appointment. And I always had something better to do. And that still hurts my heart, to this day. When my father died, it was very fast. It was about 6 months by the time, from the time he was diagnosed. And at his funeral, I was so numb, I didn't shed a tear. And it wasn't because, I wasn't sad that he died. I was certainly, but I was so numb with the things that I was doing that it took me years to grieve for my father. It really did. So, I ended up getting a job. I started as a temp with General Electric, and somehow I managed. I still have that same job 35 years later. I have no idea how that even happened. But things just, things just kept happening to me. Back in the 80s, when you got a DWI or DUI, they were much more lax. It wasn't like today when you'd be in jail, they'd yank your license. I think I got two or three of them, and I was driving on a suspended license one night, and I T-boned a cop car going through a. I ran a red light. If you're gonna screw up, do it right, don't mess around. So I went to jail, and I spent the night. And I called my mother sobbing, and she said, "No thanks. No, you can sit there." I wrecked cars. I have no idea how I lived through all that stuff. So, I ended up moving to Richmond, Virginia. My job ended. They were moving. And I had a choice to either go to Hagerstown, Maryland, or Richmond, Virginia. And someone said, "Don't go to Hagerstown, it's cow country." I didn't know what that meant really, but I chose Richmond. Lucky for you guys, here I come. And I just continued on the way I was going. I found the people at work that partied just like I did, and it became an everyday thing. Again, it was every day really From the time I was 15 till the time I found Alcoholics Anonymous in 96, I had used every day, every single day. And when I couldn't, I got irritable, very irritable and restless and discontent. So I moved here to Richmond, Virginia. And I remember I was dating someone at the time. Remember, I'm always dating someone. And I always compared, these people's actions to my own and thought everyone else was so much worse than me. What a problem this guy has. I remember I dated a postal worker. This isn't saying anything bad about postal workers, but he was different. I mean, if there was a possum in the road that had been hit by a car, he thought people were leaving that for him, especially for him. That guy ended up breaking up with me. So, I mean, that kind of gives you the idea of, I met someone and I was at a bar and it was called Visions. And I remember this guy and I was like, God, he looks just like Keanu Reeves. Oh, he's so handsome. And he had gotten thrown out of the bar. He had said that he was in between jobs and in between cars. And I remember, they booted him out of the bar. And as he walked through the parking lot, I literally ran after him. Here's my number. Call me. So a week later, he showed up with roses and he moved in. And hell yeah. And, I just, things started to get much worse. There was, consequences don't keep us sober. Consequences never, I don't know about you guys, but consequences never kept me sober. It was just something that happened due to the way that I was living my life and I was okay with it. Just remember, I didn't think anything about any of you guys, not for a second. And so I went to see a therapist because I wanted to find out why I was choosing the wrong type of med. So I went to see her and I said, this guy's such a loser. He rips the inspection stickers off other people's cars and sticks them on his own. And he drinks every day. And, things are crazy because they'd started to get physical. And she stopped me and said, so instead of talking about him, let's talk about you. What's up with you? Do you drink or smoke? I was like, well, yeah. And how often? Well, every day. But this guy. And, I remember I went back a second time. I remember looking at me and saying, I don't think I can help you. I'm not a addiction therapist or an alcoholic, counselor. I think you need some help. And I remember how mad I was at her and thinking, wow, I go to the professional community and here she, leaves me to the wolves. But for some reason, I went to the, she gave me a card and I went to this place and they did what's called an intake. And I was honest for the first time about my life and how lost I was and how much I was drinking. So they recommended that I started IOP. So I did. And I remember it was the first time being in a room with other people that, we're thinking the same way that I was, that something was wrong and I think I want help. So they had me go to AA and I had to get a sponsor and go to AA. So I walked into a huge meeting in Lakeside. It was probably about 50 people. And I was scared to death. My hands were trembling and women just flocked around me after the meeting. I was one of these angry people who came late. And left early, and I would sit in the back, relapse row, and I would jiggle my foot and just rolling my eyes. And somehow, I mean, they'd want me to go out to eat with them, and I had to get home to that prize that I was living with. And it was miserable. I'd come home, and he would be just so, like, oh, how was your meeting? It was awful. It was awful. But there was something there that started to speak to me. When I started to say yes, I'll go out to eat. And I got a sponsor and we started reading the book of Alcoholics Anonymous and something happened. I began to look forward to being at meetings instead of dreading them. And I began to look forward to seeing people and, how did it go with your husband in the hospital? And I kind of, started turning a corner in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I became firmly planted in AA. I was sponsoring women. I was in my home group. We were putting on workshops, and I was firmly planted. I was well known in the program for just being a, member of AA in good standing, a solid member. And time rolled on, and something happened during that time, and it was, I can't pinpoint when or how, but I stopped being so vigilant about treating my illness. Meetings just became so much fun. And I would go to meetings and see my friends, and we'd go out to eat, and we'd go on camping trips and do all kinds of cool stuff. I don't know if I can describe it as it lost its luster, but I was going to meetings, but I wasn't doing the work, and it took a long time for that to happen. And I, as I said, it was very sneaky and subtle. Excuse me. I can't pinpoint when it happened, but anyway, I went on Tinder, and if you don't know Tinder, it's a quality dating site where you'll meet some lovely people. So I met a man who, was an everyday pot smoker. So we met at Starbucks, and I was telling him about, oh, I'm getting scratchy again. It's allergies. I was telling him about my recovery. Sorry if I'm crackling, like I have to chew it. I'm sorry. It's the only way it helps. Forgive me. Sorry. Awful. And he was very respectful about my program. Sorry. And I said, well, what about you? And he said, well, I smoke pot every day. Had I been firmly planted in Alcoholics Anonymous, I would have said, it's really nice to meet you, and I hope you have a great life. Because I don't want to be, sorry, I don't want to be around today. I wouldn't spend a lot of time with someone who drank or used to excess. I can't. It's not good for my spirit. So I dated him for a while. Terrible. Let me try So I dated him for a little while, and I remember starting to think, I wonder how he smokes it. I wonder if it's in a pipe or in a bong. I wonder. And I was, oh, never mind. But one night I actually saw it, and I knew I was in trouble because I had no voice. I had no defense against the first drink, none, because I had put myself away from Alcoholics Anonymous. Yeah, I was still going to meetings then, but it was very subtle. Like I said, I started to drift away from the principles and from what Alcoholics Anonymous, Anonymous gave me. And before I knew it, I had done that. And I thought, I'm okay. I'm just not going to drink, but I am going to do this other thing. And how long do you think that lasted? Probably about a month, not even a month. And you guys, when I tell you it was bad the first time, the second time was horrific, horrific. I was doing the most demoralizing, horrible, tragic things. It was so much worse than when I was younger. And I thought that I had it. I would tell myself, if you can just write out of the book, if you can just manage it well, you're going to be okay. And I would, try to come to AA and just feel absolutely lonely. It was one of the most loneliest and most miserable times I can ever remember in my entire life. I was absolutely, I had nothing left. And things got bad. I'd fallen asleep. My cruise control set on 80 on I-95 coming out of DC. It was early in the morning, and I was in the HOV lane, and I fell asleep. And I remember my truck hitting the guardrail, and I still hear that noise. It was the loudest noise I've ever heard. And it wrapped around the guardrail and kept going for about a quarter of a mile. But I didn't stop after that. I kept going. I kept thinking that I could make it work. And I remember I work in a job, I'm in sales. I have a lot of big accounts, a lot of money transfers through my hands, and was making so many mistakes at work. And I was very out and proud about being in Alcoholics Anonymous. Everyone at work knew it. I didn't tell anyone that I wasn't. Of course, it's not anything you want to shout from the rafters. And I remember telling my women's home group, don't contact me for a while. I'm doing this over here. Just leave me alone. Don't reach out. It was awful. And I remember my boss bringing me into the office, and he had a stack of papers. And he was kidding. He said, "Did you change crack dealers or something?" He meant it to be funny, but he knew something was going on. And he showed me a stack of mistakes that I had made that I didn't even catch. Probably about $12,000 or $13,000 of credits that we had to end up writing to customers. And even then, it like that's a consequence, but that doesn't stop me. So it was probably about 5 years I went through that hell, and I came back into AA, and I was beaten down, and I found a woman to sponsor me, and she did. And I started to go back to meetings, very humbled, picked up my white chip and started anew. But I was listening to her, taking the suggestions that I wanted to take. And finally, she sensed that something was off with me. And she said, "Listen, I don't think I can help you. If you want to talk to someone or you want some help, maybe from a different perspective, there's a woman named Susie Donahue, and she lives in North Carolina. And she was my sponsor while this woman was in the healing place. And she said she's wonderful." So I remember calling Susie, and I spoke to her for a while and went on about things. And I'd never spoken to her before. And the first thing she said was, "What's going on? What, talk to me." And I did. And after about 15 minutes, she said, "You know what I hear?" I'm like, "What's that?" She said, "Arrogance." And I thought, "Oh, lady, no." I even think I gave the phone the finger. I just thought, "How dare you? You don't know me from Adam." I was very, very annoyed and insulted. So I called this other woman back, and I said, "I don't like her. I don't know, I've heard that everyone thinks she's wonderful, but I don't like her." So the year went on. It was another year, and I kept doing the same things that I was doing and just squeaking by at work. I would go out in the alley and take a couple of drinks and come back in, and I don't know how they put up with me, but I was sitting on my back porch, and I was using, and what I would do is I would smoke, and then I'd go out and put it in a mud puddle and smush it. And then the next day I'd be back there fishing it out. Patheticness, that's what our illness, that's what the illness does to me. And I called her back, and I was sitting on my back porch, and I was drinking, desperately wanting to stop, but not knowing how. And I called her, and when you're crying so hard you can't breathe, I was like, "Susie, remember me? It's Deja." She said, "Just breathe, calm down a little bit. And I was finally so desperate for help. And I figured if I call Susie, that's the deal. Because Susie's like, she's just helped so many people and she's wonderful and understanding, but she takes no guff from anyone. And she's honest and she's amazing. And we talked for 2 hours and she asked me three questions. Are you done for good and all? And I said, yes. She asked me, are you willing to believe in a power greater than yourself? Yes. And are you willing to go to any lengths to stay sober? And I said, yes. God, yes. So we talked for 2 hours and believe me, started reading the book that evening. She got me into the book. And I said, oh, good. I've got a big book. I have all my notes in it. And she said, get a new one. I'm like, but I don't want to get a new one. It's got all my notes in it. She said, it didn't work. Get a new book. This is a fresh start. I was like, okay, I get it. I understand. And she got me through the steps rather quickly. And I've learned when I'm working with someone, and I forgot to tell you, I have a sponsor and I sponsor women. When I'm working with someone, it's not a rush, but I try to meet with them a couple of times a week if we can to get them a solution quickly. And that's what Susie did for me. We started on the forwards, and I remember it almost felt like my spirit started to come alive again. The way she worked with me, I had a higher power. I know I haven't spoken about a higher power, and I should have. I'd always had a higher power, but I stopped seeking that higher power. So she and I, in depth, read that book, and she said, and this is what I say to women, find yourself in these pages. If you look for yourself, I'm almost in every page. And when I read with someone, I try to make the words leap out. And, these are just, it doesn't matter that this book was written, a lot of people, oh, it's so chauvinistic. It was written in 1910. It doesn't matter. The stories are our lives are the same. I am Bill Wilson. I'm Dr. Bob. You guys are Bill Wilson. Jan is Abby Thatcher, But I remember when I drove down to North Carolina to do my fifth step. And I remember Susie said, okay, find something in my apartment that reminds you of God. It could be just a little trinket or a candle, something. And I don't remember what I found it. Oh, it was a pretty little vase with flowers painted on it. And she said, put it in the chair. And I thought, this is kind of weird. What are we doing here? And she said, we're setting a place for God. So we're going to go to God before we, before we do anything. And I had clearly, Janice has said this before when she spoke, and I just love it. Part of me died that day on Susie's couch. That part of me that was selfish and arrogant, thinking that I could run my own show and swearing that I would make it work, being positive that I would make it work. That part of me died that day. And we knelt and prayed afterwards, and I had so many amends to make, and I couldn't wait to make them, but we had to do the rest of the steps first. So I remember when I made amends to my manager, I wrote on a little index card just to get my thoughts together, and never was I to say, I'm sorry, I apologize. I started out with, I was wrong. Because I've been apologizing and sorry to everybody all my life. That's some tired stuff. I was wrong. And I was like, how am I going to tell them that I was like doing stuff while I was at work? And what I said was, I was impaired and I feel like I stole from the company because I wasn't my 100% self. And he said, oh, I figured, I figured. And, he said, it took guts to come in here and say that, but it wasn't about having guts. It was just about getting right, finally getting right, and being able to look people in the eyes again and not, just want to disappear and feel, 2 inches tall. And, today my life is absolutely turned around. I can't even describe to you this time around. I'm doing Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous like I've never been before. Susie says Alcoholics Anonymous is going to be quite inconvenient for you sometimes. It's not convenient for us. Well, I don't want to go work with that girl. It's 8 o'clock at night. But when I get over myself and put others first, my heart wants to burst after I've worked with a girl. I'm working with a couple of women at the healing place, and I complained about that. Oh, I don't, it's 5 o'clock traffic. I'm just so self-centered. But I know that when I'm working with someone else and I see that light come on in their eyes, when I try to make that book jump off the pages for them and they see that there is a power greater than us which can restore them to sanity, it gives me such, it's a joy that I never ever could manufacture with anything else, doing anything else. It's the high point of my life is to work with other people. And now one of my sponsees has a sponsee, and she's always calling me just like I did with Susie. She said this, what should I do? And sometimes I'm like, well, let me check with with Susie. I'll get back to you on that. But if there's just such a sheer joy of living that I never knew was possible. And it's only through working with others and realizing that God gave me all of this. This is not of my own making. It's when I do my own making, you heard what happened. I almost died. I mean, I could ask people to raise their hands. Who almost died? Everyone would probably raise your hands. I mean, I know how to mess my life up, but I wasn't sure how to get it back. But it wasn't until I was willing to do the work. Yes, I'll do anything. I'll do anything. And that wasn't the case the first time. It kind of came in casually. And, while I was solid there for a while, I stopped being solid, obviously, because I stopped treating this, sickness of mind, body, and spirit. And, Alcoholics Anonymous comes first in all my affairs. God comes first. My sponsor is a constant in my life. We still work. We talk, we talk all the time, but once a week for an hour, we're on that phone. And Jan and I go down to see her, and she comes up here. And she spoke at Jay Walker's a couple of weeks ago, and she's the best member of Alcoholics Anonymous I think I've ever met. She taught me. Don't just walk into a meeting. Meeting starts at 5. You get there at 5 of, and you sit there and you drink your coffee and you leave. Get there early. Ask if they need help. Put your hand out to people. Talk to newcomers. It breaks my heart to see, and I used to do it too. Like you'd be at a meeting and you're talking to your friends that you've known for so long, and someone runs out the door. You know how fast we are when we're new. And I miss the opportunity to just say, hey, I'm so glad you're here. What did you think of the meeting? Or, just offer them a smile or a friendly face. I always have to be on lookout for the newcomer because that's why we're here. And there's a part in the book that I'll read to you. It's one of my favorites. And it's from working with others. And it says, life will take on new meaning to watch people recover, to see them help others, to watch loneliness vanish, to see a fellowship grow up about you, to have a host of friends. This is an experience you must not miss. We know you will not want to miss it. Frequent contact with newcomers and with each other is the bright spot of our lives. And that's what helps me be, it's somewhere in the book it says immunity. And immunity means, of course, you cannot be affected by it. So that gives me a resistance to ever going back to that life, because of the amazing things that Alcoholics Anonymous has given me. And, I'm working with a girl who's very anti-God, higher power. And there's a part in the book that's so helpful. And it says, this is in We Agnostics, and it says, we found too that it's talking about, someone that's having a hard time worshiping a higher power or believing in a higher power. And it said, we found too that we had been worshipers. What a state of mental goose flesh that used to bring on. How do we variously worship people, sentiment, things, money, and ourselves? And then with a better motive, had we not worshipfully beheld the sunset, the sea, or a flower? Who of us had not loved something or someone? And how much did these feelings, these loves, these worships have to do with pure reason? Little or nothing we saw at last. Were not these things the tissue out of which our lives were constructed? Did not these feelings, after all, determine the course of our existence? It was impossible to say we have no capacity for faith or love or worship. In one form or another, we've been living by faith and little else. And just imagine life without faith. I don't think I could. So I'm going to end it there. Thank you so much for having me, guys.
Thank you.